KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Poetry is a creative tool that strengthens Native American culture and Native people's understanding of themselves. That's among messages in a new collection of essays by Native poets called Indigenous Poetics. Osage poet Elise Passion's new book, Blood Wolf Moon, dives into her family and tribal history. And Mother by M.S. Red Cherries explores Native identity and community in the 1970s and 80s. We're celebrating Native poetry after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska organizations that provide weather and environmental information to mariners and subsistence hunters are bracing for reduced funding. The cuts have not been approved, but according to a draft budget memo, the Trump administration is considering slashing more than a quarter of the funding for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in 2026. The Alaska Ocean Observing System is a NOAA program that provides coastal and ocean data to improve the safety of boaters, fishermen, and subsistence hunters. The executive director of the organization, Shana Wisdom, says the proposed budget would eliminate the program.
It would completely shut us down, and we have projects across Alaska. We would be pulling assets out of the water.
The organization's projects include supporting indigenous observers who track changes in their communities, mapping whaling trails, and monitoring harmful algal blooms. In another project, hunters in Point Hope, Utqiagvik, and Wainwright collaborated with scientists to install buoys at popular subsistence locations to track wave height. The buoys then provide real-time data via an app when it's safe to hunt. Steve White is the executive director at Marine Exchange of Alaska. The organization partnered with the program to install weather stations on vessels so that other boaters get real-time conditions from remote areas. He says losing such initiatives would be a huge hit to a state that already lacks weather reporting.
Up in Alaska, you got to have good weather information. It could determine whether you die or whether you come back or whether you should go out on a boat or not.
If the proposed changes go through, the Alaska Observing System is unclear whether the program will have an alternative path to stay operational. Meanwhile, a Navajo Nation Council delegate is optimistic about meetings this week with the Trump administration in Washington. Brenda Jesus, chair of the Council's Resources and Development Committee, was among a group of Navajo representatives to meet with U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and staff with the White House Council on Environmental Quality and the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs for Local and Tribal Governments. Jesus says the purpose of the trip was to talk with the new administration, advocate for the committee's priorities, and urge for tribal consultation in Trump policies. The Navajo Nation, located in the Southwest, extends into Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico.
We all know that Navajo Nation has a vast abundance of resources, setting the stage as to, okay, Navajo Nation wants to acquire that self-governance, but we would like to continue to hold our federal partners to proper and meaningful government-to-government or tribal consultation.
Topics of discussion included the Chaco Canyon land withdrawal in New Mexico, which the committee says has stalled key infrastructure for Navajo people like water, electricity, and roads. Talks included ongoing problems with abandoned uranium mines and water access as an urgent need. The visit was made about a week after Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin attended a White House event where Nigrin showed his support for boosting coal development across the U.S., an action the Trump administration is taking. Jesus says coal is a sensitive topic and the committee has not taken a position, but will be meeting on it.
We need to have a better practice going forward should we go back into the coal or the fossil fuel industry, and actually maximize out the benefits that will be coming from this.
Jesus is one of 24 Navajo Nation Council delegates. She says the current council has 18 months left of service, and the work they're doing now is setting a blueprint.
I'd just like to continue to have the Navajo Nation prosper just through any development on Navajo Nation and hope that it will be a return to Navajo.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll be right back. National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org. Support by the Gathering of Nations Powwow, a live event taking place April 24th, 25th, and 26th at the Expo New Mexico, featuring song and dance, Trader's Market, Horse Parade, Stage 49, and more. Tickets at gatheringofnations.com and at the gates. Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fmbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. If you're interested in understanding a person, place, or idea on a deeper, more thoughtful level, poetry might be the medium for you. Poetry challenges readers to think and think creatively. Poets also enable readers to understand ideas and problems that are hard to put into words. A new collection of essays makes a case that Indigenous ancestors have always been poets. The book, Indigenous Poetics, talks about the power and importance of poetry. We'll talk with one of the editors to help us understand more about this current boom in Indigenous poetry. We'll also talk with Elise Passion, author of Blood Wolf Moon, which gives readers an Osage history lesson and a look into her life as the daughter of famed ballerina Maria Tall Chief. And M.S. Red Cherries, whose first book of poetry, Mother, was named a 2024 National Book Award poetry finalist. Please join today's celebration of Native poetry. Tell us who your favorite Native poets are and what poems have had an impact on you. You can call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Pawhuska, Oklahoma, is Elise Passion. She's a poet and the author of Blood Wolf Moon. She is Osage. Elise, hello, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Joining us from Woodland, California, is Ines Hernandez Avila. She's a poet and co-editor of Indigenous Poetics with Molly McGlennon. She's Nez Perce enrolled on the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation. Ines, hello and welcome to the show.
Honored to be with the two other guests.
Yeah, absolutely, Ines. Thank you so much. And joining us from Columbia, Missouri, we have M.S. Red Cherries. She is a poet and the author of Mother. She's a citizen of the Northern Cheyenne Tribe. Hello, MS. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. I'm very honored to be here, especially with the two other guests. Thank you.
Yeah, all of you folks. This is a great lineup we have. And Elise, I want to begin with you because you just had an event for your book launch last night at the Osage Nation Museum. How did it go?
It was so wonderful. I actually was so happy to have Tall Chief family members there, our Tall Chief community, our Osage community. And it was a great gathering. So happy to bring this book back home to the Osage.
Well, let's talk about the title first, Blood Wolf Moon. What's behind that?
So the title comes from an actual phenomena which occurs in the month of January. It's called the Super Blood Wolf Moon, and it's an eclipse. It happens infrequently. So I took a little poetic license. I'm not quite sure it happened the month and the year I was born. There's a line, it's part of a long poem called Heritage, where the last line of the first poem becomes the first line of the next poem. And the line is, I was born in the month the Blood Wolf Moon. So it comes from a scientific fact, but it also has a lot of poetic resonance for me.
All right. Now, Blood Wolf Moon, it's a collection of various poems that you've written. They're formatted differently. The tone changes. It kind of goes back and forth. I really have enjoyed reading it. Tell us more about the theme that runs throughout the book and how you chose these specific poems and the order in which you present them.
Thank you so much, Sean. So this is my sixth poetry collection. It's the first collection I've written as a book-length project. So my hope is that when readers read the book, they'll read it from beginning to end. It's modeled after the five acts of a play. And I wrote the first section, that long poem called Heritage, inspired by my Osage background, my Tall Chief storylines, lots of poems about my mother, Maria Tall Chief. And I carved out the rest of the manuscript. So I hoped that there would be a contrapuntal rhythm, there would be tension, and there would be cessation of tension. And I was just hoping to grip the reader in a way that you would read a novel and that, you know, it would be one of those books of poetry where you start and you don't want to put it down till you're done.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so
you succeeded.
My idea behind the narrative and the trajectory of Blood Wolf Moon.
Okay. Yeah, I think you really nailed it there. And going back to your famous mother, Maria Tall Chief, who is such a huge figure in the arts world internationally, but you also write about her as just your mom too, and just talking about that, sharing that relationship with readers. Tell us a little bit more about that and how you chose to just present your mom as a regular person in some ways.
Thank you for noting that. Yes, so my mother has inspired me throughout all my books of poetry, and so in every book you'll see a poem or two about my mother, and this is like a deep dive into mother-daughter relationship. I've tried to write a memoir based on a summer when I was young, and my mother left my dad and took us to France, where my Aunt Marjorie Tall Chief, who was a 12 with the Paris Opera Ballet, was living. And that summer, my mother fell in love with a dancer, Rudolf Nureyev. And so this was a prose book I was trying to write around 2011, 2012. And when my mother passed away in 2013, I just didn't want to write that anymore. And so I wanted to bring in some of those texts. So there's sort of this hybridity aspect to this book, which is sort of a new direction for me as well. And so I took some of those prose chapters and turned them into prose poems. And again, it kind of, you know, my cousin Russ Tall Chief introduced me yesterday along with our chief, Jeffrey Standing Bear. And Russ was saying that he thinks this is one of my most personal books. So there are aspects of the mother-daughter relationship that are explored in this book that I haven't explored in other books.
And a lot has been written about your mother, but this personal relationship, is some of this new information that's never been shared publicly before?
Yeah, I guess not. I'm okay. Her daughter, so I don't know who else would have shared it. I haven't.
All right. Well, you've got a poem that you're ready to read. It's titled After Killers of the Flower Moon. Can you introduce it to us and then read it?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So just a little bit of background behind After Killers of the Flower Moon. A line from my earlier poem, Wiggia, helped to inspire the title for David Graham's book and Martin Scorsese's movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. The line from Wiggia reads, during Zaga Ziga Setha, the killer of the flower's moon. So several years ago, I was here, I was in Tulsa actually, and attended the Osage Nation premiere of the movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. And I had a chance to spend time with Lily Gladstone. Lily portrays Molly Burkhart, whose family was murdered during the Reign of Terror, 1921 through 26, a tragic period, as I hope our listeners all know, of American history when outsiders killed the Osage for their oil head rights. So yes, I think that's a good little intro. Okay, here's the poem. And this is actually one of the last poems I wrote for the book. After Killers of the Flower Moon. Lily Gladstone confides she wore my great-grandmother Eliza's blankets in three scenes. I don't remember my great-grandmother, though in a photo, age 90, she holds me in her arms. The actress plays Molly Burkhart, who lived down the street from Eliza in Fairfax. Hands out wide, Lily says Eliza had a broad wingspan. She pleated the wool broadcloth several times. Through an open window, wings outstretched, an eagle owl looms toward Molly's mother, dying from poison. My mother told me that owls in trees wailed the windswept night before her father died. Wrapping my great-grandmother's striped blanket around her shoulders, Molly asks her husband during a downpour not to close the window. Be still, she says, and listen to the rain. Eliza's blankets fold and unfold stories. Into every pattern, I fly back home. The Osage replaced hide robes with dust-traded blankets in the mid-19th century. I stop breathing during the night of film when a murderer calls Osage women blankets. While her husband injects Molly with arsenic, each sister is shot, poisoned, or bombed to death. A woman in a voiceover foreshadows, this blanket is a target on our backs. In the quiet, after Molly's obituary is reported, I only hear rain. Outside the theater, silent thunderbirds overhead spread dark cloud battered wings, outlining circles across a broadcloth. Inside each target, a hole in the sky.
Elise, that is really, really a beautiful poem. It's tough. I mean, it'll draw some tears there. Did you read that last night?
I did not read it last night. I launched officially the book at the Poetry Foundation last week. And I read that poem at the Poetry Foundation, and I got very emotional when I was reading it. So, yes, I agree with you.
Okay. Well,
thank
quick question before.
That.
Yeah, you. But we've got to take a break here. But I just have a quick question. Molly Burkhart's husband. He's referenced, but not by name. Is that intentional?
I think I didn't want to get too distracted. So obviously her husband, or not obviously, obviously to me, her husband is Ernest Burkhart, and he was played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And I was just trying to keep the storyline as straight as I could in this poem, because we had my great-grandmother, Eliza, my mother, her father, Molly Burkhart, Lily. So I didn't want to get too caught up with naming Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie, the actor who played Ernest Burkhart.
All right, Elise, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back. We're going to continue our conversation with Elise and our other guests. And the phone lines are open for listeners who would like to join the conversation. 1-800-996-2848. Tribal leaders in Washington and Michigan say the proposed oil pipeline known as Line 5 underneath the channel connecting two Great Lakes threatens their waters, their treaties, and their future. The Trump administration is fast-tracking the pipeline tunnel as part of what it says is an energy emergency. We'll hear more about the direction of Line 5 on the next Native America Calling.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Cosmic dust was the spark of spirit given to us. In all the years of her existence, with benevolence and generosity, she provided for our subsistence and never needed our assistance. But now the world is in distress due to unrestrained excess. Nature reveals that true progress is possessed by every plant and tree that echoes every breath we breathe. in a symbiotic symphony of connected sustainability. In the present tsunami.
You are listening to Native America Calling, and we are celebrating Native poetry today. April is National Poetry Month. What Native poets are you reading right now? I want to know. Pick up the phone and call us. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our first guest is on the line, Elise Passion. She's a poet and author of Blood Wolf Moon. And Elise, I want to ask you one more question before we bring in our next guest, MS Red Cherries. And it has to do with Osage language. You use a lot of Osage words in your poems. And in the book, there's even a glossary of Osage language words and English translations.
Yes, thank you so much for talking about this aspect of the book as well. So throughout my years of writing my books, the Osage dictionaries have greatly inspired me. So originally it was Francis LaFleche's Osage Dictionary, then it was Carolyn Quintero's Osage Dictionary. Now the Osage Nation has its own dictionary online, and it's based on the orthography, and we're one of the few nations to actually create our own language system, so our own orthography. The Osage Nation Language Department created it in 2012 to 2014 is when it was finalized. So it's a very, very new language. And so throughout this book, I try to integrate Osage words in a way to reclaim our Osage language on the page. The last three poems, as you're talking about, came from the Carolyn Quintero Dictionary. And I wrote it originally with the phonetic spellings and with the English translations. And then realizing that our Osage orthography was in existence, I then asked Christopher Cote of the Osage Nation Language Department to provide that orthography. I have an earlier poem in section 5 called Wajaje, Osage, and I had that with the Osage phonetic spelling, and I was able to translate those words into Osage orthography with the help of our Osage Nation Language Dictionary. So it's a very exciting time for the Osage, and I'm actually taking Osage language classes. I've been in class now for about a year and a half, and I'm very inspired by our language, and it's a way to have a vision of the way our ancestors lived. So very grateful to the Osage Nation Language Department.
Yeah, that's so exciting. We did a couple of shows when Killers of the Flower Moon came out. We had Chief Standing Bear on the show. We had Christopher Cote. And the word you just used, I think that was also one of the songs, one of the soundtrack songs. It was a title.
Yes, it was. And it was up for an Academy Award.
Right, right.
And I actually flew out here to Pawhuska to be with the Osage for the Osage Academy Award Oscars party. And so we were rooting for the song. We were rooting for Lily Gladstone. But it was great to be with everyone during the Academy Awards.
Right on, right on. Well, Elise, great job. Again, just a wonderful, wonderful book. I really have enjoyed reading it. And let's talk about another book and another poet. We have MS Red Cherries on the line. She is poet and author of Mother. And MS, let's start with that title. In your book, it has a lot of meaning and subtext. Can you start with how the title relates to the topics of adoption and Native identity that you explore?
Yeah, I mean, the title came about very organically. The book itself is about the separation between a mother and child, specifically through adoption or being adopted out. And so the book rests in these stories of the narrator's origin. You know, where did the narrator come from? You know, where are her people at? Where is her mother? And so the title kind of, it just came about very naturally. The center of the narrator's world is the mother. That's where she began. And so it's kind of this exploration through family stories and lore about the mother as the narrator remembers.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine as a poet, sometimes you'll have people come up to you and they'll just want like a quick summary, and they'll say to you, tell me what your book's about, or tell me what's your poetry about, what's your focus? And when you're confronted with questions like that, what do you answer?
I just I say, well, it's obviously called Mother. And so, whatever Mother means to you or the reader, it's a family story about a mother and child who were separated at birth, pretty much.
All right. Well, tell us more about the poems that you wrote, how you chose them, and the order with which you present them in your book.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book initially as a novella. And so there is kind of a groove, there is a narrative that follows, that carries the stories throughout. And so each of the poems I consider stories. And so it was, ordering a collection of short stories, finding where the moments and the pulse are, and then ordering the poems to those moments. And there's, it's beyond mother as well. I mean, there's stories about a father and a brother and a sister, and it's just kind of creating this, encapsulating this family.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was fortunate enough, the publisher sent me an advanced copy, so I got a hard copy version, and I enjoy these poems. I like them a lot, and the themes that you touch on. And tell me a little bit more about your writing process and what it takes for you to just get these ideas and these thoughts on paper. And how long have you been writing poetry?
Not long. I mean, I just started really, really writing about 5 years ago. I got into a MFA program in Iowa, and the cumulative project is your thesis, your MFA thesis. And so this was my MFA thesis. And so I began the project the first semester during the first workshop in fall 2019. And I slowly began crafting these vignettes, which is what I initially called them, were these like little brief, micro narratives, micro fiction moments. And I just started writing what they are now called poems, just very, very throughout the 4 semesters that I was in Iowa in my MFA program.
All right. Well, you have a poem that you're going to read for us as well. It's titled Riding the Highway 212. So go ahead and set this up for us, and then please read the poem.
All right. Yeah. This was just a poem that I feel like is, it captures what the core of Mother. It kind of tells about the narrator and the longing for the mother and visiting the mother. Riding the Highway 212. Mother, I'm picking up speed and the ice is getting thicker. I'm on my way to see you. I'm coming to see you. I haven't been home in a couple years, but I'm driving the miles back home. The reservation always feels extraterrestrial, like the International Space Station, a condensed bubble of sky, clouds, sun, and moon. Always surprised they are the same ones that rise above you. I look at the bare map on the bare road, which makes a two-dimensional map seem even flatter, and I pass familiar road signs. I see the Catholic Church, the nicest building in town, and I see the river. I'm looking at the river and remembering a story you told me about my sister. You said she once got so drunk during a party, she fell into the river and forgot how to swim, and then someone pulled her out. My brother says it was you, but you said it was him. My sister doesn't remember, but she cried when she made it to land. I also remember you telling me that the river was poisoned by the neighboring coal mines. You said that the fish in the river were sick, and so was the river. I remember meeting a cousin for the first time one summer when I visited home from college, who told me about the center of the universe. He was so happy to have finally met me because I was your daughter. He thought the world of you, so he thought the same of me. He called himself a river rat, and the next summer he drowned. It is hard to think that a river who has fed and kept us alive has also taken so much from us. Poison in the shadow of coal mountains. I pull into your yard and I knock on your door. You answer and you tell me to sit down. You have been sick for a little bit of a long time, and I know that. But now your sickness is so loud, it asks if I ever thought of where I want to be buried. And I say yes, wherever you are.
Yeah. MS, this is just another really, really beautiful poem. And it's another one that's tough to listen to. And I'm reading it along with you right now with the book, and it's just so moving. And, is this in any way autobiographical?
It is, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, most of the collection is auto-fictional. A lot of it is based on my own life and my mother.
Yeah. In the river that you're referring to?
Yeah,
what river?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tongue River.
Right. Yeah. Geez, this is a really, really good one. There's just so much insight. What I like about this is it's just a whole nother way. There's some of the topics that you touch on, like adoption. There's a lot of stuff here on boarding schools, and it's just a whole nother way for readers to get this information? You know, there's a lot of nonfiction that's being written, and there's some novels that are being written. But the way you present this history, and some of it's personal and some of it's broader, and these concepts through poetry is just it's another way to read it. And I really appreciate that. I find it really, really valuable. What kind of feedback are you getting from other readers?
One of the main comments is people, they're surprised at how much love the narrator has for the mother. They're surprised how the narrator is not angry at the family for, you know, putting her up for adoption or you know, adopting her out when she was a child. And you know, I think that is I think that's the core of mother, is that there is no, you know, hard feelings between the mother and the child, the mother and the family, the child and the mother, the child and the tribe. It's about the child reconciling the loss, but who is responsible for this loss? And I in the book, I hope it's answered that it's America that's responsible. It's no individual's fault. It's not the tribe's fault. It's America for creating these circumstances. It's all love between the family, complete love. And I think that essence it's, you know, people have that's a big comment that I've been asked about. It is why is there no anger toward the mother? And I think that's it, is that it's no one's fault. But if it is anyone's fault, it's this country's fault.
Now, your name and many of the proper nouns in your writing, they're not capitalized. Tell us why that is.
Oh yeah, I capitalization puts a special emphasis on a word, whether it's a capital. You know, if there's a, you know, state, if that's capitalized, that, you know, to probably the state in which, like, you know, a contract is formed and then the like. I'm a practicing attorney. I practice law. And so the capitalizations of states and names are very important to drafting memoranda or drafting contracts and things. And so in this book, I didn't want to capitalize any state name. I didn't want to give states the respect, because I feel like they're occupying tribal homeland. And so that was my little form of resistance and refusal to acknowledge their territories.
Now, you shared earlier that you're relatively new to writing poetry. Who are some indigenous poets that you draw inspiration from?
My favorite poet and who's now a friend, I'm very grateful to call her a friend, is Layli Long Soldier. And in 2019, my mentor, the director of my MFA program, she gave me a stack of books, and she told me, she said, you need to read these. I think they would help your work. And one of the collections was Whereas by Layli Long Soldier. And I truly believe if I hadn't have read Whereas, I don't think I could have written this book. Since then, I've been, you know, introduced to the canon. E.G. Ockpick, who wrote Corpse Well and Blood Snow, I believe was nominated for a Pulitzer, if not last year, the year before. She's one of my, you know, favorite poets right now. Cedar Sligo. Riding the Highway 212 is based on, or is after a James Welsh poem called Riding the Earth Boy. And that poem to me is just so electric, and it's something that I look to for, you know, just inspiration. It's the perfect poem.
Well, let's go back to writing the Highway 212, because that poem, it's near the end of the book. And can you talk about where in the story this poem refers to?
How so?
Well, just with regard to the overall narrative of the book, like, why did you choose to put that poem? It's on page 103. I'm just interested how you chose where to fit it.
Oh yeah, I think it is toward the end of the book, and it's toward the end of the section describing who the narrator is, and it was honestly a final scene to show to really, really narratively show the relationship between the mother and the speaker, because up until that point it's poetry, right? So it's kind of vague. There's a lot of swirling going on, but there's not a lot of telling. And I felt like this poem was the core and like led the reader into the true narrative of the entire collection. And I wanted it to just end on that moment.
Okay. Yeah. That's really cool. I like that. And unfortunately, we don't have enough time for you to read this poem, but it was one of my favorites. It's titled Engine, Engine. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, I mean, that was my first attempt at a short story, at a traditional short story where there's a, you know, there's a beginning, you know, a middle, a climax, a resolution. And it's still pretty small. I mean, it's pretty tight. It's on, I think it takes up 6 pages maybe. And it was just kind of my idea of a short story and kind of a road movie during, not a road movie, but a road story during kind of a retelling of a historical fiction of the moon landing of 1969, where I saw like this Indian on the moon instead of like a non-Indian. And what would that mean? You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was a cool concept. The 2024 National Book Award Poetry Finalist Honor, how's that worked out? Has that opened doors and opportunities for you?
It has. And I'm entirely grateful for making a finalist. I don't know how these things happen. It was such a surprise. I'm incredibly grateful. And it's just introduced me to many, many people that I read or like that are my heroes. And now, you know, being able to speak to them or to be in conversation with them has just been such a dream. And so in that way, it's led me to a wider community, especially of Native writers. And I'm just incredibly grateful. I don't think me and Elise, we went on this trip to Italy last fall to talk about Native poetics. And I don't think I would have been on the trip with Elise had I not, you know, been involved with the National Book Awards. And so it's been opportunistic, and I'm very grateful for it.
That sounds exciting. Elise, what do you remember about this trip to Italy?
Oh, it was such an incredible experience for MS and myself and three other poets, including Craig Santos Perez. And I just do want to say that I'm a founding board member of Indigenous Nations Poets, and MS is one of our INAPO fellows. So it was so gratifying that to have, you know, a board member and our poet, and you know, I'm such a huge fan of MS's. So it was quite an incredible experience, I know, for both of us, I think.
All right. Well, we got to take a break here in about another 30 seconds. But MS, do you have a lot of readings or events lined up?
I do. I'm in Columbia, Missouri for a book festival. It's called Unbound Book Festival. And I'm on a panel tomorrow, and I have a couple readings over the weekend. And yeah, I think I'm just tying up the spring, but very grateful. So thankful.
All right. Well, continued success to you, MS. And again, we do have to take a short break, but we'll be back and we'll begin our conversation with Ines Hernandez Avila. So stay with us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so at 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Trickster Cultural Center hosts the 11th Annual National Gathering of American Indian Veterans to honor veterans and military personnel of all cultures, eras, and branches in a Native way. Trickster Cultural Center's National Gathering of American Indian Veterans is open to the public at no charge Friday, July 18th and Saturday, July 19th in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at tricksterculturalcenter.org/national-gathering-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show. Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org. Are you or someone you care about looking to take their education to the next level? Native Forward Scholars Fund is here to help. With awards up to $30,000, Native Forward Scholars Fund is dedicated to supporting Native students as they pursue higher education. With Native Forward Scholarships, you can overcome financial barriers and open doors to a world of opportunities. Native Forward Scholars Fund, working to build a brighter future and empower Native students one scholarship at a time. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The North Slope Marketplace is now open. Arctic Slope Regional Corporation shareholders and descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
This is Native America Calling. There is still time, folks, to join today's conversation about Indigenous poetry. What are your favorite poems? Who are your favorite Native poets? Tell us, 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We've got a caller on the line right now. This is Donna. She's listening on KNBA in Wasilla, Alaska. Good morning, Donna. It's been a while since you've called in. How you been?
Oh, really good. I know. I used to be always on there. My relatives would say, how do you get on there? And I just call. Anyway, I am calling because I write poetry. I've been writing poetry for over 50 years. And my mom was raised by Chief Wawiwa of the Paiute tribe and his wife, who was blind. And so I wrote a poem about her, and I'd like to read it.
Just real quick, about how long is it?
Very
Donna?
Short.
Okay, yeah, go for
Very
it.
Short.
Please do. Yeah, I just
like
want to check. Go for it. Go for it.
Okay.
Go for it.
Your loving is called Loving Hands. Your loving hands made homemade bread. Laughing, running children ran through the wild plum bushes. Your loving hands made jam to go with the homemade rolls. Your loving hands ironed freshly laundered clothes with devotion. Cheerleader, musicians, cook, pastor, business leaders, and Native dancers, your loving hands guided us through life. We were secure knowing you were there. Your loving hands crocheted bedspreads for our large beds, wiped our noses in tears. A deep calm enters knowing my angel mama is smiling from heaven. Your loving hands will live forever through your children and grandchildren. Your loving hands will live forever in my heart, angel mama. Your legacy is your deep love and unselfish devotion to all your children.
Oh, geez. Donna, Angel Mama, that is really, really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that so much. How often do you write poems?
I'm going to publish a poetry book, and I got my poems copyrighted, and maybe the most famous one will be about the presidents. Because it's all about the presidents, and it's a real long poem, and I sent it to President Reagan, was the first president I sent it to, and then I sent one to Bush and Clinton. And I didn't send one to Obama or Trump, because I've really been busy raising my grandkids.
All right, Donna.
But they're getting older now, so...
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in. And please, don't wait so long to call in again, all right? All right, we're going to go now to Woodland, California, where we have Ines Hernandez Avila on the line. She is a poet and co-editor of Indigenous Poetics with Molly McGlennon. And Ines, thank you again for joining the show. And in your book, it's really captivating. It's kind of a behind-the-scenes look at Native poetry. You have poets sharing how the craft builds and strengthens society. Where did this idea come from? And I love the cover, by the way.
Thank you. And first of all, Kachiaoya, and thank you, and Tochmewi. Good morning to everyone. The idea came because I was a faculty member in Native American Studies at UC Davis, and I was the literature person, which is sort of ridiculous, really. When you consider how huge the field of Native American literature is, I would have loved to have had, you know, a couple of other colleagues working with me so we could really, really do something grand. I did my best, but anyway, I always noticed how my colleagues would say, oh, poetry, yeah, that's really nice. And in a way, sort of marginalize the idea of poetry as being relevant to Native American and Indigenous studies. And I kept thinking about that, and I thought, you know, poets are critical thinkers. Poets you know, and I really love that the last speaker spoke about Layli Long Soldier, because you can look at Layli Long Soldier's poem 38 and you, it gets across something that an entire book, and I think you mentioned that too earlier in the show, but it gets across something that's really huge in a way that maybe a 600-page book wouldn't. And so Molly is one of my students. We have a graduate program in Native American Studies at UC Davis, and Molly was one of my first student. And so I'm very proud of her, because she's full professor at Vassar and just doing remarkable things. She has an endowed chair. And so it's kind of, you know, we return to work to work with each other on this book, because these questions matter to us. And I was thinking when Elise was reading that in our call, we sent out a general call. We didn't pick people for the book. We it was a broad call. And one of the questions we asked was, how does poetry enhance language revitalization? And what ways do poets center poetry, creativity, and language revitalization efforts? And that's what Elise did when she read her poem, right? You know, and so we have poets in the collection who do work very, very deeply with their languages. And we're really happy about that. But the other question we posed was, you know, how does poetry help us to excavate meaning from difficult problems and questions? And what is it about poetry that allows for the expression of consciousness and conscientiousness through each individual's connection of the dots in abstract form, to offer incisive perspectives on difficult problems and questions, and sometimes in abstract form, and sometimes more, you know, a form that's very, very personal, very, very clearly accessible. But we wanted to really give poets a chance, as you said, to explain the craft and explain their process, mm-hmm. and demonstrate that that there is everything, you know, to do with the way we think about things in poetry. Yeah.
Well, let's talk more about that, because I mean, this is it. These essays that the poets write, I mean, they're really in depth, and like, this is a really like behind the curtain look at what goes into the thought process of a poet and how they choose their themes and their style. And it's like a tutorial. So how did you choose these specific poets to include in the book? And then their specific essays and the topics that they address, how did you choose those as well?
Well, we chose each person who submitted a proposal told us what they would like to write about. And based on those proposals, and we made, you know, we knew we couldn't include everybody, you know, it's a pretty finite collection. So we settled on the poets that we included in the collection, and they wrote for themselves. We did not, you know, this is a place, it was a space for poets to be able to do what they wanted. And we were delighted that they did that. So we didn't have a hand in any of the essays, other than, you know, in the proofreading stage, just, you know, looking at tweaking mm-hmm. here and there, and the editing stage, we might have asked, maybe we could move this paragraph up over here, you know, but it wasn't anything. We were not.
Sure.
Editor, we did not.
Okay. However, though, you did write an essay for the book. It's titled Memory Strings, Formative Moments in My Life with Poetry. Tell us about your essay.
The idea of memory strings is a Nez Perce term, and that I learned from my friend and colleague, Angel Sabata, who is a language teacher in Lapwa, and she's finishing her dissertation, her PhD. And the memory string it can be worn as a bracelet, and And in our way, we place those beads in particular colors. Only the person making it really knows what the color is representing for him, her, or them. But and then we use brass bells to mark the transition, and brass beads. And then there's a little bell that's connected to the string to sort of remind you with a gentle ring of the bell what that whole process was about. And so that's why I use that as a framing for my essay, because I looked at the formative moments in my life that brought me to poetry. And I've been with poetry all my life, even though, because I was in academia, you know, that's the one thing that Molly and I both had in common also, that we were in the universities. And so we were having to abide by, you know, what we had to do as professors and you know, teach our courses and do all the service work and everything. So we didn't exactly get to live the poetic life in the way that others have done who are focusing on that as their way, as their path in life. So I'm probably one of the oldest in the collection, and I was a poet in the 70s and with all the social movements were going on. And so I was clear that about how poetry could lift the spirits of the people. And I was clear about that connection, that communal connection, if you will, between the heart of the poet and the heart of the people. And so that mattered a lot to me. I was captivated by that, because in my early years, some of us in Texas got so excited about an early Mesoamerican concept of poetry that talks about poetry as the path to truth. And so we got so excited that we went into the schools, K-12, and gave workshops to children and young people on poetry is the path to truth. And the teachers even got excited and started asking us for training so that they could continue that teaching. And I just love, you know, my essay is about how much I love the way poetry communicates broadly, mm-hmm. very intimately, personally to readers. Yes. But when it's delivered in community, there's something else that happens. There's something else that happens, that it's a magic.
So what you're describing is, if a person just like myself, if I sit down and read a book of poetry, that's one thing. But maybe when a poem is read to a community setting, like in a library, to a group of people, are you saying that's a different type of energy?
It's another type of energy, you know, and it's a way, I think it's a way for, you know, I'm going to take this, my example is from Mexico, where I've seen so many indigenous writers who write in their languages and then translate into Spanish. And so when they go into their communities and do readings in their communities, they read in their languages and thereby give dignity, you know, to the language, and therefore to the people and to the culture, because denigrated. And you know, we know that up here, we know that everywhere, you know, in the hemisphere, that, you know, we weren't supposed to speak our languages. And so whenever our languages are spoken in a way, in a community where there are people who still understand what you're saying, you know, or even if they don't, they realize that you're a part of them and they're a part of you, and you're out there and you're doing your thing, but you're doing your thing knowing that you're representing, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That's a really beautiful.
It is. It is. Ines, you mentioned earlier you've been a poet since the 1970s. Here it is now, 2025. We're a quarter of the way through the century. I still can't get over how quickly time flies. But what is it that's so special about this current moment in Indigenous poetry?
Oh, my goodness. I think that we're really, really moving. And I have to mention Kim Blazer, Kimberly Blazer, who is an exquisite poet, artist, professor emerita from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, but she's the founder of Enopel. And she's just driven, and I love it. You know, she just moves, and Enopel now has a language back section, a focus. I see, of course, you know, what we all know, Joy Harjo with her 3-term as poet laureate of the United States, Natalie Diaz winning the Pulitzer Prize in poetry in 2020. Even, you know, the Dene Poets Reader, the Dene Reader, I think is important in the moment we're living in right now in terms of poetry, because it's an example of poets from a particular Native nation coming together, not poets, poets and writers, poets and fiction writers and essayists and so forth, thinkers coming together and showing us their different voices, you know, in one text, and elevating where we are in literature in that way, right? Because that's it's good that we do that. It's good that we show who we are as peoples.
Ines, I'm sorry, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up the conversation, but really appreciate you joining the conversation as well and talking about your book along with all the other guests today. So we had Ines Hernandez Avila, MS Red Cherries, and Elise Passion on our show today. And with that, we do have to wind it down. So we'll be back next week, and we'll kick off with a show about a proposal to build a tunnel under the Great Lakes for a new Line 5 oil pipeline. Our executive producer is R. Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Joe Thompson is the UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Show McPolin, digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is a distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. Jacqueline Saliz, the CEO and president of Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AmeriND.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Quantic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite.